Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. The Bet by Anton Chekhov. It was a dark autumn night. The old banker was walking up and down his study and remembering how 15 years before he had given a party one autumn evening. There had been many clever men there, and there had been interesting conversations. Among other things, they had talked of capital punishment. The majority of the guests, among whom were many journalists and intellectual men, disapproved of the death penalty. They considered that form of punishment out of date, immoral, and unsuitable for Christian states. In the opinion of some of them, the death penalty ought to be replaced everywhere by imprisonment for life. "I don't agree with you," said their host, the banker. "I have not tried either the death penalty or imprisonment for life, but if one may judge a priori, the death penalty is more moral and more humane than imprisonment for life. Capital punishment kills a man at once, but lifelong imprisonment kills him slowly. Which executioner is more humane? He who kills you in a few minutes, or he who drags the life out of you in the course of many years?" "Both are equally immoral," observed one of the guests, "for they both have the same object, to take away life. The state is not God. It has not the right to take away what it cannot restore when it wants to." Among the guests was a young lawyer, a young man of 25. When he was asked his opinion, he said, "The death sentence and the life sentence are equally immoral. But if I had to choose between the death penalty and imprisonment for life, I would certainly choose the second. To live anyhow is better than not at all." A lively discussion arose. The banker, who was younger and more nervous in those days, was suddenly carried away by excitement. He struck the table with his fist and shouted at the young man, "It's not true. I'll bet you 2 million you wouldn't stay in solitary confinement for 5 years. "If you mean that in earnest," said the young man, "I'll take the bet. But I would stay not 5, but 15 years. 15! "Done," cried the banker. "Gentlemen, I stake 2 million. "Agreed. You stake your millions, and I stake my freedom," said the young man. And this wild, senseless bet was carried out. The banker, spoilt and frivolous, with millions beyond his reckoning, was delighted at the bet. At supper he made fun of the young man and said, "Think better of it, young man, while there is still time. To me, 2 million are a trifle, but you are losing 3 or 4 of the best years of your life. I say 3 or 4, because you won't stay longer. Don't forget either, you unhappy man, that voluntary confinement is a great deal harder to bear than compulsory. The thought that you have the right to step out in liberty at any moment will poison your whole existence in prison. I am sorry for you." And now, the banker, walking to and fro, remembered all this, and asked himself, what was the object of that bet? What is the good of that man's losing 15 years of his life and my throwing away 2 million? Can it prove that the death penalty is better or worse than imprisonment for life? No. No. It was all nonsensical and meaningless. On my part, it was the caprice of a pampered man, and on his part, simple greed for money. Then he remembered what followed that evening. It was decided that the young man should spend the years of his captivity under the strictest supervision in one of the lodges in the banker's garden. It was agreed that for 15 years he should not be free to cross the threshold of the lodge, to see human beings, to hear the human voice, or to receive letters and newspapers. He was allowed to have a musical instrument and books, and was allowed to write letters, to drink wine, and to smoke. By the terms of the agreement, the only relations he could have with the outer world were by a little window made purposely for that object. He might have anything he wanted, books, music, wine, and so on, in any quantity he desired by writing an order, but could only receive them through the window. The agreement provided for every detail and every trifle that would make his imprisonment strictly solitary, and bound the young man to stay there exactly 15 years, beginning from 12 o'clock of November 14th, 1870, and ending at 12 o'clock of November 14th, 1885. The slightest attempt on his part to break the conditions, if only 2 minutes before the end, released the banker from the obligation to pay him 2 millions. For the first year of his confinement, as far as one could judge from his brief notes, the prisoner suffered severely from loneliness and depression. The sounds of the piano could be heard continually day and night from his lodge. He refused wine and tobacco. Wine, he wrote, excites the desires, and desires are the worst foes of the prisoner. And besides, nothing could be more dreary than drinking good wine and seeing no one. And tobacco spoilt the air of his room. In the first year, the books he sent for were principally of a light character, novels with a complicated love plot, sensational and fantastic stories, and so on. In the second year, the piano was silent in the lodge, and the prisoner asked only for the classics. In the fifth year, music was audible again, and the prisoner asked for wine. Those who watched him through the window said that all year he spent doing nothing but eating and drinking and lying on his bed, frequently yawning and angrily talking to himself. He did not read books. Sometimes at night he would sit down to write. He would spend hours writing, and in the morning tear up all that he had written. More than once he could be heard crying. In the second half of the sixth year, the prisoner began zealously studying languages, philosophy, and history. He threw himself eagerly into these studies, so much so that the banker had enough to do to get him the books he ordered. In the course of 4 years, some 600 volumes were procured at his request. It was during this period that the banker received the following letter from his prisoner. My dear jailer, I write you these lines in 6 languages. Show them to people who know the languages. Let them read them. If they find not one mistake, I implore you to fire a shot in the garden. That shot will show me that my efforts have not been thrown away. The geniuses of all ages and of all lands speak different languages, but the same flame burns in them all. Oh, if only you knew what unearthly happiness my soul feels now from being able to understand them. The prisoner's desire was fulfilled. The banker ordered 2 shots to be fired in the garden. Then, after the 10th year, the prisoner sat immovably at the table and read nothing but the gospel. It seemed strange to the banker that a man who in 4 years had mastered 600 learned volumes should waste nearly a year over one thin book easy of comprehension. Theology and histories of religion followed the Gospels. In the last 2 years of his confinement, the prisoner read an immense quantity of books, quite indiscriminately. At one time he was busy with the natural sciences, then he would ask for Byron or Shakespeare. There were notes in which he demanded at the same time books on chemistry and a manual of medicine, and a novel and some treatise on philosophy or theology. His reading suggested a man swimming in the sea among the wreckage of his ship and trying to save his life by greedily clutching first at one spar and then at another. The old banker remembered all this and thought, tomorrow at 12 o'clock he will regain his freedom. By our agreement, I ought to pay him 2 millions. If I do pay him, it's all over with me. I shall be utterly ruined. 15 years before, his millions had been beyond reckoning. Now, he was afraid to ask himself which were greater, his debts or his assets. Desperate gambling on the stock exchange, wild speculation, and the excitability which he could not get over even in advancing years, had by degrees led to the decline of his fortune, and the proud, fearless, self-confident millionaire had become a banker of middling rank, trembling at every rise and fall in his investments. Cursed bet, muttered the old man, clutching his head in despair. Why didn't the man die? He's only 40 now. He will take my last penny from me. He will marry, he will enjoy life, will gamble on the exchange, while I shall look at him with envy like a beggar and hear from him every day the same sentence. I am indebted to you for the happiness of my life. Let me help you. No, it's too much. The one means of being saved from bankruptcy and disgrace is the death of that man. It struck 3 o'clock. The banker listened. Everyone was asleep in the house, and nothing could be heard outside but the rustling of the chilled trees. Trying to make no noise, he took from a fireproof safe the key of the door, which had not been opened for 15 years, put on his overcoat, and went out of the house. It was dark and cold in the garden. Rain was falling. A damp, cutting wind was racing about in the garden, howling and giving the trees no rest. The banker strained his eyes, but could see neither earth, nor the white statues, nor the lodge, nor the trees. Going to the spot where the lodge stood, he twice called the watchman. No answer followed. Evidently, the watchman had sought shelter from the weather and was now asleep somewhere, either in the kitchen or in the greenhouse. If I had the pluck to carry out my intention, thought the old man, suspicion would fall first upon the watchman. He felt in the darkness for the steps and the door and went to the entry of the lodge. Then he groped his way into a little passage and lighted a match. There was not a soul there. There was a bedstead with no bedding on it, and in the corner there was a dark cast-iron stove. The seals on the door leading to the prisoner's rooms were intact. When the match went out, the old man, trembling with emotion, peeped through the little window. A candle was burning dimly in the prisoner's room. He was sitting at the table. Nothing could be seen but his back, the hair on his head, and his hands. Open books were lying on the table, on 2 easy chairs, and on the carpet near the table. 5 minutes passed, and the prisoner did not once stir. 15 years' imprisonment had taught him to sit still. The banker tapped at the window with his finger, and the prisoner made no movement whatever in response. Then the banker cautiously broke the seals off the door and put the key in the keyhole. The rusty lock gave a grating sound, and the door creaked. The banker expected to hear at once footsteps and a cry of astonishment, but 3 minutes passed, and it was as quiet as ever in the room. He made up his mind to go in. At the table, a man unlike ordinary people was sitting motionless. He was a skeleton, with the skin drawn tight over his bones, with long curls like a woman's and a shaggy beard. His face was yellow, with an earthy tint in it. His cheeks were hollow, his back long and narrow, and the hand on which his shaggy beard was propped was so thin and delicate that it was dreadful to look at it. His hair was already streaked with silver, and seeing his emaciated, aged-looking face, no one would have believed that he was only 40. He was asleep. In front of his bowed head there laid on the table a sheet of paper on which there was something written in fine handwriting. Poor creature, thought the banker. He's asleep and most likely dreaming of the millions, and I have only to take this half-dead man, throw him on the bed, stifle him a little with the pillow, and the most conscientious expert would find no sign of a violent death. But let us first read what he's written here. The banker took the page from the table and read as follows. Tomorrow at 12 o'clock I regain my freedom and the right to associate with other men. But before I leave this room and see the sunshine, I think it necessary to say a few words to you. With a clear conscience, I tell you, as before God who beholds me, that I despise freedom and life and health and all that in your books is called the good things of the world. For 15 years I have been intently studying earthly life. It is true I have not seen the earth nor men. But in your books I have drunk fragrant wine, I have sung songs, I have hunted stags and wild boars in the forests, have loved women, beauties as ethereal as clouds, created by the magic of your poets and geniuses, have visited me at night, and have whispered in my ears wonderful tales that have set my brain in a whirl. In your books I have climbed to the peaks of Elbers and Mont Blanc, and from there I have seen the sun rise and watched it at evening flood the sky, the ocean, and the mountain tops with gold and crimson. I have watched from there the lightning flashing over my head and cleaving the storm clouds. I have seen green forests, fields, rivers, lakes, towns. I have heard the singing of the sirens and the strains of the shepherd's pipes. I have touched the wings of comely devils who flew down to converse with me of God. In your books, I have flung myself into the bottomless pit, performed miracles, slain, burned towns, preached new religions, conquered whole kingdoms. Your books have given me wisdom. All that unresting thought of man has created in the ages is compressed into a small compass in my brain. I know that I am wiser than all of you. And I despise your books. I despise wisdom and the blessings of this world. It is all worthless, fleeting, illusory, and deceptive, like a mirage. You may be proud, wise, and fine, but death will wipe you off the face of the earth as though you were no more than mice burrowing under the floor. And your posterity, your history, your immortal geniuses will burn or freeze together with the earthly globe. You've lost your reason and taken the wrong path. You've taken lies for truth and hideousness for beauty. You would marvel if, owing to strange events of some sorts, frogs and lizards suddenly grew on apple and orange trees instead of fruit, or if roses began to smell like a sweating horse. So I marvel at you, who exchange heaven for earth. I don't want to understand you. To prove to you in action how I despise all that you live by, I renounce the 2 millions of which I once dreamed as of paradise, and which now I despise. To deprive myself of the right to the money, I shall go out from here 5 hours before the time fixed, and so break the compact. When the banker had read this, he laid the page on the table, kissed the strange man on the head, and went out of the lodge weeping. At no other time, even when he had lost heavily on the stock exchange, had he felt so great a contempt for himself. When he got home, he lay on his bed, but his tears and emotion kept him for hours from sleeping. Next morning, the watchmen ran in with pale faces and told him they had seen the man who lived in the lodge climb out of the window into the garden, go to the gate and disappear. The banker went at once with the servants to the lodge and made sure of the flight of his prisoner. To avoid arousing unnecessary talk, he took from the table the writing in which the millions were renounced, and when he got home, locked it up in the fireproof safe. And that was The Bet by Anton Chekhov. I'm Trev Denny. I'm very, very happy to be joined by Neil Poole to talk to you about that story and the man himself, Pooley. Number two for us. I'm looking forward to this one. Again, the same question as I started off on last week's show. What was your initial impression when you encountered Mr. Chekhov's story for the first time?
My initial impression was that there was a page missing at the end when I first read it, because it just ends, and I literally turned over the page as I printed it out, and I thought there must be more on the next page, and there wasn't. So my initial impression at the end was slightly nonplussed in terms of thinking, what is that it? But right up until that point, I've absolutely loved it. I think when we did the lottery sort of is a really, really slow build, and then, you know, at the end you get that sort of punch at the end, and that's where the sort of story is almost at the end. With this one, you've got a really sort of strong central idea around the bet, which is like really, really interesting. I love stories that I quite like it. It's almost like, you know, it's a story based on the type of conversation you have in the pub, you know, when you've had 4 pints.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's just like really like quite interesting type of conversation that you would have. And I just like these sort of types of sort of like 19th century stories. It's a bit like Around the World in 80 Days, you know, this idea of the big bet. So I absolutely loved the premise of it, and I got into this immediately. And I'm putting it this way, from the point of view that this is a 19th century Russian writer, I couldn't believe how accessible it was and how easy it was to read. So as I said, went through the story, loved it, was totally engaged in it throughout. At the end, I was slightly confused, but that was at that point that I thought that. But then having read back over it a few times and having sort of listened to you reading it and just sort of giving it some sort of thought and sort of started to unpick it, the end now makes a lot more sense to me in terms of there is no answer, and I don't think there's supposed to be an answer at the end of this story, which I'm sure we'll get on to later. So I'm now okay with the end. Initial reactions was slightly confused, but in terms of did I like it? Not immediately, but I absolutely love it now. It's definitely one of those sort of that grows on you. But Trev, I've got a question for you
Go
related
on.
To this. Okay, I just because I said it's a 4-pint question. I know we haven't had 4 pints, but would you rather be imprisoned for life or executed?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm delighted that you framed your response to the story the way you did, because I think an awful lot of people will have just listened to it and have exactly that same, is that it? Reaction to the suddenness of the end. And I think, again, as you say, further visits back to it will really, really reward folks if they want to do it. And hopefully the few things we'll say here might make that second reading or listening all the more sort of fruitful for them. But the question that you've posed there, of course, the central question, really, the chief conceit of the whole story, it's a mad one. You can't not think about it, because as you say, it's one of these kind of grandiose things that you associate with that era and men of certain social status and standing with money to spare, and they can do these things. What is it our friend the banker says? He calls it like the caprice of a pampered man. And, you know, in many ways, I can't relate to that at all, Pooley. I can't relate to the concept of a fella who'd be willing to take on that bet. But if you're offering me a straight choice, I would obviously come down on the side of the lawyer and his insistence that to live anyway is better than not at all. Although the man who comes out, who crawls through that tiny window at the end, we'll come to it later on, but he's broken, you know? So it's a difficult one, man. I mean, it shouldn't be difficult. And my choice there, I think, is the one that everyone would say, well, common sense says you want to preserve your life. That's what people do. But when you see the creature that emerges from that room, that's where the question kicks in. What about yourself?
Yeah, well, I think that's what makes it interesting, because I don't think it's a choice for me. I'm with the lawyer all day long, and exactly like you said, it's that quote, isn't it? It's better to live somehow than not to live at all. I think by the end of this story, though, if you were to go on the evidence of a piece of fiction, it would appear that the banker's actual point of view is possibly correct in terms of, you know, like you said, the broken man that comes out of it, the sort of 15 years of torture. And it is 15 years of torture that he goes through when you actually look at it. It looks like there's purple patches, and there might be a few, but essentially at the end, throughout it, he's in a lot of trauma. But no, I mean, and I think that's what's really interesting about it, is that I think it's an absolute no-brainer. I mean, I'll be honest with you, I have quite an intense fear of death, and that might be what's behind it. Ever since I was 14 and I saw Young Guns 2, I had this real sort of... this is true. I had this real vivid reality check of the existential terror of never existing again. And sort of... So I've always had that. I can really imagine that and bring it to sort of life quite quickly, the whole idea of not existing. And it is absolutely sort of terrifying without being too bleak. So therefore, for me personally, it's like, God, yeah, in whatever conditions, I would rather live as long as possible. When they're answering that question, these characters have got a different context of what imprisonment is than what we have now. So obviously, the idea of being in prison for life now, you know, they're not great, and the dangers that are with that is probably not quite as harrowing as it was in 1898 in Russia. And that's beyond penal colonies and things that I'm sure we'll talk about later. I haven't looked into it. I think the life of a prisoner in 19th century Russia that was just put in a inverted commas normal prison was very much in solitary confinement. Not the absolutely insane level of solitary confinement that is conjured up as part of this bet. But I think it's probably a harder question than it is now, because I think the imprisonment for life is probably far, far worse then than it would be now. That's sort of my take on it. But me, no, live forever, death all.
Yeah, I'm very taken by young Pooley with his existential dread at the age of 14. God love you.
I cried, Trev. I cried.
That's a touching moment. And look, unlike with Shirley Jackson, it's no disrespect to Shirley, I feel like we need to sort of put a little bit of context around Chekhov the man. He has such a weighty influence in terms of modern literature. Obviously, he's from that great Russian tradition of writers as social and political commentators. You know, he's pushed out with Pushkin and Gogol and Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn, all these great figures. But an awful lot of their stuff, you know, you talk, as you were talking about, you know, the horrors of prison life in that era, I was thinking of something like the Gulag Archipelago, and you're thinking, that's some grim stuff. But with Chekhov, there's this real wit and humour and sort of joie de vivre and urgency and I don't know, something immediate about the way that he writes. And I came across this brilliant quote. It's from a story called An Artist's Story, which is kind of a grim enough tale. It's a very sad story. But right in the middle of it, it's like he can't help himself. There's this quote from Chekhov in the middle of it, which is, "Hundreds of miles of deserted, monotonous, scorched steppe cannot produce such gloom as one man when he sits and talks and nobody knows when he will leave." And I just think, yeah, that's just like just that little wry observation in the middle of this otherwise bleak story. Yeah. It's just perfect. It really sums him up. And
because that's how he started out, wasn't it? He started out just like writing sort of really short, like humorous, satirical pieces for magazines that he thought were like quite throwaway. So his background is in that, isn't it?
Exactly. And he was quite harsh on himself in regards to the way that he wrote and criticized those early writings as kind of just very, very perfunctory things that he was doing very much to earn money for his family, which is what the reality of the case was. And look, I mean, again, just to put it into context, and you'll bear with me here for a second. I mean, it's the timeline of his life, 1860 to 1904. That in itself is fairly tragically short. But when you think about the burst of creativity that emerged, I mean, he was brought up in a very humble background. Most of the great writers that we hear of these times are, they're from more moneyed middle-class backgrounds. Not so with Chekhov. He's basically one generation removed from serfs, which is a kind of a indentured servitude, basically. And he has this background where he's got a tyrannical father and a nurturing mother, and his father's declared bankrupt because basically he's a bit of a spendthrift. He overextends the family's finances, building a new house, and he gets cheated by a contractor. And to avoid debtor's prison, he has to flee to Moscow. Chekhov remains behind and supports his own studies by private tutoring, by selling short sketches to the newspaper, and, Pooley, by catching and selling goldfinches. I mean, that's a little detail that I just loved. I don't even know what that's about, but brilliant. He is studying to be a physician and qualifies in 1884 as a physician. He considers this all through his life to be his principal profession, even though he makes bugger all money from it. He treats the poor free of charge. This is what we learn as we read more and more about him, is that he seems to have been a very solid fella, just a kind of a decent man. Yeah. His quote, "Medicine is my lawful wife and literature is my mistress," kind of sums that up. And, you know, despite himself, he just grows and grows in terms of his fame and his recognition. He's becomes quite the public figure, along with the likes of Ibsen and Strindberg. He's probably one of the main figures in modernism and in theatre. Most people will know at least one of his plays, The Seagull, Uncle Vanya, Three Sisters, The Cherry Orchard. I read somewhere, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, Neil, but I read somewhere that he's the second most produced playwright ever after Shakespeare. Does that sound like something you might have come across as well?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I didn't know that a week ago, but having sort of done my revision, as I called it earlier, that's something I came across as well. So, good stat, Trev, good stats.
Good stats, yeah. It's important to throw out these stats. You know, it's as a dramatist that he's mostly known, but I do like these quotes that you keep getting from the fella himself, and we'll come back to them. I know you've got one or two of them that really sort of reflect what he thinks writing's all about, which is basically, I don't need to be overtly political. I don't need to have any great philosophy. And that will feed back into our chat about this specific story in a minute. Yeah. I just need to faithfully reproduce what I see happening, or a conversation I heard, or a thing that I witnessed. And if I do that, I'm doing my job. And again, yeah, I know you've got a very good quote on that. We'll come back to it later on. Another little fact that feeds into this story again, after his brother Nikolai dies from tuberculosis, which eventually takes Anton as well, he gets into a bit of a state of depression and restlessness, starts researching prisons as part of his law studies, and he becomes obsessed with the issue of prison reform. He becomes massively interested in the rights and protection of the human dignity of people in these various penal colonies and prisons. And again, this will have relevance to what we're talking about and what we'll be talking about later on in this story. And there's one more thing that I really do want to focus on, because the first night of, and again, this is just a personal thing, and you'll forgive me for indulging myself here, Pooley, but on the
you're
a good man like that. On the opening night of The Seagull, which is his first big play, I mean, it's a bit of a fiasco. The play is booed off. Chekhov goes into a bit of a sulk. He renounces the theatre altogether. But there's a little twist here, because the theatre director, a fellow called Danchenko, is so impressed with it. He convinces his colleague, Konstantin Stanislavski, to direct a new production for the Moscow Art Theatre. Stanislavski pays particular attention to psychological realism, and he likes trying to coax out the subtleties in the text, and this really hooks Chekhov back in. He can see his work being mined for the depths that it actually has. And they go on and they produce Uncle Vanya, and he has tremendous, tremendous success with his plays from there on in. And what I love about it is Stanislavski is a guy who has a tremendous influence on American cinema later on. This whole subtextual approach to drama, you know, the likes of Elia Kazan, who's a big director in the 40s and 50s in Hollywood, Lee Strasberg, who forms the Actors Studio and teaches the Stanislavski method to people like Brando and later De Niro. And there's this like through line from Chekhov to them via Stanislavski that I love. It's just connecting two of my passions, and as a result I found that very, very interesting, and maybe some people might want to look into that themselves. And I'm going to finish just a blurb about Chekhov himself with a quote from a man that we will hopefully cover, and depending on copyright issues, Raymond Carver, who is, again, a tremendous writer himself. And his take on Chekhov is that his stories are wonderful and necessary, as necessary now as when they first appeared. It's not only the immense number of stories he wrote, for few, if any, writers have ever done more. It's the awesome frequency with which he produced masterpieces. Stories that shrive us as well as delight and move us, that lay bare our emotions in ways only true art can accomplish. You're getting that from Raymond Carver. You're doing well. So I did enjoy that. A nice way to finish, I think, a general introduction to Mr. Chekhov. And of course, Pooley, the show itself nearly took its name from the man. I did intend to call the show Chekhov's Gun, which is a reference to a dramatic principle, basically, that it basically requires that every element in a story has to be necessary and irreplaceable. No superfluous detail, basically. So Chekhov himself said, remove everything that has no relevance to the story. If you say in the first chapter that there is a rifle hanging on the wall, in the second or third chapter, it absolutely must go off. If it's not going to be fired, it shouldn't be hanging there. I like that. You know, again, you said yourself, when you're revisiting this story, you see the economy of it. You see the layers and layers and layers. And I know you're, as a man who's written short stories yourself, the mastery, the art is so deep. Every aspect is essential. No superfluous detail. Everything is there for a purpose. I love that.
Yeah, and you know what, I think that's coloured my thinking of this story, and it's why it's just driven me slightly insane, but in a good way. I really like it, is that because you've got that, you know, Chekhov's gun theory, you've got that quote in the back of your head, so you're thinking, right, so everything does mean something. We know that he thinks that. It's the opposite of what we talk about Shirley Jackson, where with Shirley Jackson literally said, it's just a story. It's the opposite of Chekhov's gun, isn't it? It's like she's saying, it's just a story. You don't really need to read anything into it. Well, he's saying, like, everything has a relevance. And I think in terms of going back over the story again, that being there in your mind, and you were saying about how You know, he got into frenzied research of prison reform, and then he became obsessed and everything. As you were saying that, all I was thinking to myself was, well, that sounds a lot like this lawyer, actually, doesn't it? In terms of the frenzied research he gets
Yes,
into, these
yes.
periods of obsession, and then leading back around, coming very circular around to my point. I think I almost became a little bit like this as well with this story, where I became obsessed with trying to find detail in everything, and got quite annoyed when I couldn't find sort of meaning in everything, you know. So I don't know, this sort of 3 degrees of separation of Chekhov going a little, getting a bit obsessed, the lawyer getting a bit obsessed, and me getting obsessed all around this story. So no, it is, I love it when we can tie all these things together.
We've had a. It's a bit like Inception, isn't it? You know, we've
Yeah,
got
yeah, yeah,
there are
yeah,
layers here, but I think you're right. And with that in mind, when I again the little details, you're wondering why is it a fireproof safe? Why is that relevant? You know, you're asking yourself stupid
yeah.
questions like that. You know, and so everything becomes potentially layered with meanings. So let's tease out some of the big ideas in
Very,
this.
very, very quickly, because I will absolutely forget.
Oh yeah, go.
Only if you've got it at hand. What's the quote? I mean, this is another thing. I've not heard any of these quotes before, at all. Sounds like we're doing a magic trick, but honestly, I didn't have prior knowledge of these quotes. But just read that other one out again if you've got it at hand. The one about the boring man and the sort of, you know, the landscape, the scorched landscape, or whatever it was.
So it's basically it's a quote from an artist's story, and the quote is this: "Hundreds of miles of deserted, monotonous, scorched steppe cannot produce such gloom as one man when he sits and talks, and nobody knows when he will leave."
Right, don't you think that that is a lot like the men at the start of this story? These like sort of really sort of know-it-all, really stubborn, they know best. It's just like there's this crowd of men who none of them will sort of give any leeway. They're all right and what have you. And this is, I mean, we were talking about this earlier. It's like you assume that there's a hero, you assume that there's a villain. I can't help think that. As much as we say that Chekhov doesn't have any opinion on this, I don't think either of these characters come across as particularly likable or particularly heroic. They're both full of faults. I mean, obviously one he's got sort of 15 years in prison, which is a terrible environmental situation to be in. That could make you start not thinking straight. But when you've just said that quote, then it does. The nagging thing that I've had in the back of my mind was. I don't even know if Chekhov really likes these characters. They don't come across as particularly likable. And then when you sort of throw that quote about, you know, men who just go on and on and on, I mean, isn't that exactly like the scene that we come into with this story? Just men talking and talking and talking. Obviously, that's what we're doing as well. But you know what I mean? It's like these men who just go on and on. I do wonder if Chekhov likes these people in this society as such, and if he doesn't, does that colour what we think of the story? But anyway, that's just come from the quote that you told me.
But I like that, and it does kind of set us up to have a look at one of the big ideas here that I know you wanted to talk about, and it's basically this idea of you're right. I mean, they're blowhards, and everyone can picture there was a little movie version that it was quite good, but again, I just didn't bother with it. I watched like a couple of seconds of it and left it to one side. I always prefer just look at the text, but. You can just picture it. You know the scene here. It's cigars and smock coats and tumblers of brandy and like I say, blowhards who are convinced of their own greatness. And there's nothing likable about the banker at the start. He is the ultimate blowhard. He's talking about all the money he has. He tries to convince the guy that, you're making a mistake here, Chief. You still can pull out. Don't worry about it. This money's nothing to me. And the other guy has this sort of almost like a sort of a takes almost like a petulant delight in being, I'm going to do this thing and I'll sacrifice my freedom and I'll prove my point. And it is a foolish, foolish bet. And I know you wanted to talk about the concept of the power dynamic that happens when there is a big bet done, a large gamble of this nature. What was it you were saying to me during the week about that? What was your idea around that?
Now, I was just thinking that the power dynamic in this, in particular, is very reflective of all bets of all gambling, and that is that the person who proposes the bet is always in the position of power. Say, for example, you're just in a pub with your mates, and then one of your mates says, "I bet you I can or can't do something that would seem really difficult to do." Well, if you take up that bet, it's very, very blatant that they are going to win that bet because they wouldn't propose that bet if there wasn't a trick behind it. And it's the same with, like, even if you're betting on horses or footballs and you're going to, the bookmakers or whatever, it's all done on the terms of the bookies. They're the ones who set the odds. They're the ones who decide it's 3-1 or 5-1. It's like the person who proposes the bet always has the power and always has the upper hand. And I think this is very much the case in this bet as well. I mean, don't get me wrong, the lawyer makes it even worse for himself when he stupidly turns it around and says, "Then I'll bet I'll stay not 5 but 15." It's like, what are you doing that for? There's literally no reason to make it more difficult for yourself other than to just be completely petulant and stubborn. And then when you actually look at the bet and what the bet ends up being is quite far removed, I think, from what that initial argument is. So that initial argument is, what's worse, to be executed or imprisoned in life? Okay, so even if we take it into the context of it's imprisoned in a Russian prison in 1890 or around that time, okay, and even if you sort of take it to the view that they're all in solitary confinement, those conditions are still absolutely different and quite light in regards to what actually happens to this lawyer, where he has no connection with any humans as well. Lives in complete silence in terms of human voices and what have you. And all of a sudden, they're not actually gambling on the situation they were talking about in terms of being imprisoned for life, you would think, in the context of a Russian prison or being executed, because it's all about capital punishment. That's entirely what it's about. So it is about that state system that's in place. But when this happens, he ends up in the man's house, 15 years, no contact with any humans. Then he's got this weird thing where he can essentially, there's like, he's got access to Amazon or something, by the way, where he can just access all the books and things like in the world. Obviously not Amazon, right? But the whole conditions and the whole sort of terms and conditions of this are drawn up by the banker. Okay, so once this bet is made, he then, is really, really sets up what this sort of bet is like. And then also at the end, when it looks like he's gonna like lose the bet, he's still looking to move the goalposts, to use a football analogy. And he thinks he's gonna lose the bet, so he's gonna kill him. He goes to kill him at the end. I think we're all quite clear on that, and blame the watchman if he can. So all the way throughout this bet, it's the banker who's sort of controlling everything, and I think it is quite reflective of bets in general and gambling in terms of the house in Las Vegas doesn't lose. You never see a skint bookmaker. It's like the house always wins, and in this, it's like, what? The house in more ways than one really does win. And I just sort of thought it is quite interesting that you could sort of take a context from, 1890 or whatever it is, and you sort of take it to now, and it's like people are still acting in the same way. I mean, again, this whole idea of a bet, we joked then about, the way he rises it from 5 to 15. But I mean, I've sat at a casino and played blackjack and roulette. That's exactly what you do. You lose your mind. You have these real sort of impulses, like you do things that aren't rational. So I think in that context, I mean, the story is called The Bet, and so it feels like a decent sort of point to start off with, as we just have, in terms of what does this say about bets and gambling. And I think it essentially says that, the house always wins, and that's shown in this.
Yeah, again, it comes back to that phrase I think we both use there, is about the power dynamic, isn't it? And I'm delighted that we've started off and that you've gone there with that opening part of our discussion here on the story itself, because you'll have, probably like myself, in the course of your research on this, opened up the stuffy academic websites and seen people holding forth about how this is a story about the death penalty versus life imprisonment. This is a story about these kind of highfalutin concepts like that. And actually, it's not. In many ways, it's kind of not at all. In many ways, it is about that act of capricious challenge and acceptance at the start. It is about the nature of that confinement being solitary and what that does to a man and a man's mind. And it's so it's not this kind of, I found it very disheartening to read some of the, you know, you think about people and they're going with the best will in the world and trying to inform themselves and have a look at, you know, some of the more traditional sites that give you some background at that. And there's such guff written, Pooley, such guff written under the guise of academia. It's terrible. If people have actually engaged with the text itself, they will know within 2-3 paragraphs that's guff. That's not what this is about. And I'm going to segue from what you gave us there into another big idea that I think is absolutely central to this. You've talked about the banker, and he's inherently unlikable from minute one to the end, where he's contemplating murder and fobbing it off on his own employees. This is not a good fella. But the guy who's...
I knew you were going to say but, by the way. I was waiting for the but.
Well, the but...
Big buts don't lie, Trevor.
And the big but in this context is, how do you feel about the guy who is engaging in this voluntary confinement, who is isolating himself from human contact, and about the evolution that he undergoes in that prison setup, in that sort of again voluntary confinement. So let's tease that out a bit, because one of the big things I wanted to talk to you about and get your take on is what I consider one of the major themes of this story is wisdom versus knowledge. Right? And knowledge versus experience. So in the book, we have this beautiful metaphor of the books being the man's sort of window into the world and all the experience of the world and all the knowledge of the world. And again, in one of those flat, imagination-free academic sites, that was it. That was put across like that. That was it. But there's another layer. And the other layer, the more important layer, the thing that engages you, the thing that you actually really start to get the cogs in your brain going, is the idea that this experience, in inverted commas, that he talks about, it's all vicarious. It's not real. There's not one moment of lived experience that he has because of the nature of his solitude. And, you know, we have this gorgeous passage that he comes up with himself, where he's talking about, what he's read and the experience that he's gained from the books. He says, for 15 years, I've been intently studying earthly life. It's true that I've not seen the earth nor men, but in your books, I have drunk fragrant wine. I've sung songs. I've hunted stags and wild boars in the forests. Have loved women, beauties as ethereal as clouds, created by the magic of your poets and geniuses, have visited me at night and whispered in my ears wonderful tales that have set my brain in a whirl. In your books, I have climbed the peaks of Elbers and Mont Blanc, and from there I have seen the sun rise and watched it at evening flood the sky, the ocean and the mountain tops with gold and crimson, and so on. And he goes on to say, in your books, I flung myself into the bottomless pit, performed miracles, slain, burned towns, preached new religions, conquered whole kingdoms. Your books have given me wisdom. All that the unresting thought of man has created in the ages is compressed into a small compass in my brain. I know that I am wiser than all of you. Now, I read all of that because it's absolutely essential to the point I'm trying to make here and what I want you to react to, which is I think the real sadness for me at this of this story is that when he turns around after what he's just said there and says, I despise all of that, I despise everything you stand for, I despise your books, I despise your knowledge. To me, that's the voice of a broken man. That's a man who's gone through all these cycles in his in his time. He's tried to experience everything he can via the books. They are his portal to human experience. And he hasn't had one bloody actual experience. And that to me, Pooley, is the tragedy of this story.
It is the tragedy of it. And I totally agree with you. But I'm really, really happy that he does go on and say that extra thing. Because I think if you end it at, you know, all of the parts that you've just read in terms of, you know, I had all of these experiences through reading books. Okay, if you'd ended it at that point, I'm calling this out as full cliche. I'm not particularly good and not particularly interesting. I mean, when I was reading that bit for the first time, the thing that really came to my mind was, have you ever read Dr. Faustus by Christopher Marlowe, which is, you know, it's obviously all about, like, well, essentially, the lawyer in this comes across very much like Faustus in the play Dr. Faustus, where he's a Renaissance man, because obviously Dr. Faustus is written in a Renaissance period, and it's written at this time, sort of in the 16th century, where everyone's discovering art and science, and there's this really big explosion of knowledge. So when I was reading this for the first time, I'm thinking, oh, they're going down the Renaissance man route. Yeah. You know, he didn't have to live it, blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't particularly impressed with that, not least because I can't empathise with it and I don't agree with it. So it's a little bit of a leap of faith for me to sort of go along with a character saying that. So when he then turns around and then says, but I despise your books, and then, you know, he goes on to literally pull the rug under everything he's just said, that's when I think it gets really, really interesting. Not least because I didn't understand why it didn't make sense at first. It's like, well, wait there. You either did learn from those books, or you didn't.
Yeah, I think that will confuse a lot of people. Honestly, yeah. I do, and I think an awful lot of people would have preferred that kind of a sop where it ends, where you talk about it ending. But the fact that he turns around, I mean, what does that say? We've full disclosure, briefly discussed this before the mics went live. But again, I'm going to ask you for the record, what do you think that says when he turns around and says, to prove to you in action how I despise all that you live by, I renounce the millions and I'm going to climb out the window and free you of this. And he says, like, I despise your books, I despise wisdom and the blessings of this world. It's worthless, fleeting, illusory and deceptive like a mirage. What do you think is happening to that guy? What is his mental state? And we'll talk again maybe in a few minutes about his physical state when the banker comes into the room. But his mental state there, what do you think has happened to him?
I think what's happened is he's been there for 15 years, okay? He has a tough start at the beginning where, you know, we're being told that, you know, he's suffering and he's lonely and he's bored and whatever. It's almost like he has an immediate, like, sort of cold turkey from society and human connection. And the first part of it is like, the hardest for him, okay? But then after that, when he then decides to start, you know, ordering his books and what have you and everything, I think at that point then, it looks like he's probably done what we would all do. It's like, you know what, I've got nothing else to do. I will learn lots and lots of things. You know, I'm pretty certain that's probably what most people listening to this podcast would do. There comes a point, if you're just in isolation, what do you do? You know what, I'll just learn something, I'll learn languages. Why is he doing that? Then it's the eternal question is, you know, I think he's like looking for the answers to the big questions in life. He's looking for meaning. He's looking for all of those things. So I think he then spends the best part of 15 years looking for all of these answers. Okay. But what he then ends up doing is he goes through all of the, you know, the different areas. So he's looking at literature and he's like looking at science and he's looking at learning languages. And then he goes to the Bible and he goes through all of these things. He flip-flops from one thing to another over this 15 years. And I think what then happens is, if you're looking for these answers for 15 years And because a lot of these answers, like we said, they're like they're secondhand experiences, they're not entirely tangible, you could probably kid yourself for so long that you know that they are real. But the reality is, you know, they're not real. And whatever you read is always going to be secondhand. It's another person's visualization of, you know, mountains or whatever. Even with science and whatever, you know what I mean? So there's probably lots of things in 1890 that would be proven to be wrong now and will be in another 100 years. So I think he looks for all of these answers and he doesn't find these answers. And then at the end, he goes entirely nihilistic, where after sort of a search for 15 years, looking at all different aspects of life, he's out of that. He has no definitive answers. He has no answers. And then he does that sort of thing, what you do, where you sort of throw your toys out of the pram and you just go, well, the whole thing's pointless. What's the point? We're all going to be dead. And honestly, right, I'm going to go off on a 30-second tangent, Trev. Don't worry. I'm going to bring it back to a safe place, okay?
Okay.
Well, you know what it reminded me of? I went to Edinburgh a couple of weeks ago with my family, and then it was a nice day. And I said, you know what we're going to do today? I said, we're going to go up Arthur's Seat, which is like a big hill or whatever, in Edinburgh. And my six-year-old son turns around to me and he goes, what are we going to do when we get there? I was like, well, we're just going to get to the hill and we're going to climb to the top of it. And then he turned around and went, so what? We're going to climb up a mountain. And for what? Nothing. And that, right. And you know what? Sometimes kids are good. They can say things exactly as they are. And I was thinking, yeah, it's got a sort of point there. But it is that really, really sort of naive, innocent, not egocentric, but sort of naive, innocent, juvenile sort of approach, and a way to sort of look at life in anything that you're doing. And it's the whole cliche, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And I think very much the lawyer here is just like, he's literally crestfallen by the fact that he hasn't found the answers that he wanted. And he just gives up on life. He literally gives up and he goes, what's the point? What is the absolute point of all of this? Which is obviously a ridiculous point of view, in my opinion. But and I think that's why he's so crestfallen at the end. He's essentially spent 15 years trying to look for some meaning in life and hasn't found it. And then he's just had some sort of existential crisis, spiritual breakdown, whatever it may be. And he's just, you know, he's just lost the plot, essentially.
Well, if somebody is going to develop very solipsistic tendencies, it's going to be a man who's literally alone. And you kind of have to forgive that. But yeah, I think you're right. I think there is that next stage that he takes it to, and it is nihilistic, and it is sort of just everything is bleak. There's nothing to any of this. But what you have to remember, again, to come full circle back to the thing I started off with here, is that he has had no experience. None. I mean, he hasn't had a jam sandwich on a hilltop with a friend talking nonsense about a football match they saw. He hasn't felt the breeze in his face as he walks along the shore. He hasn't spoken to someone in an aggressive way and then regretted it afterwards. He has had no experience. So
that's absolutely poetry. Get that written down.
But you know what I'm saying. So yeah, yeah. So of course the nihilism is going to come in. Of course the very nature of his life will lead to that kind of literal navel gazing and solipsism. But here's the thing, what about the physical appearance? Because when the banker comes into the room to do him in, essentially, the story says, at the table, a man unlike ordinary people was sitting motionless. Now, that line really resonated with me, and I was kind of, what's he saying here? Why is he unlike ordinary people? And then we get the description of him with his long curls like a woman's, his shaggy beard, the skeletal sort of figure, the skin drawn tight over his bones, hollow cheeks, back long and narrow, his hand so thin and delicate it was dreadful to look at it, his hair streaked with silver, he's emaciated, and yet he's only 40. Now, there's obvious sort of things that come into your mind there. You know, in many ways, there's that kind of almost Christ-like sort of appearance of him, right? I think that might be a red herring.
I agree. I don't think it's that.
But and again, can I make the most absurd point of the night? Because on my second or third reading, I was thinking, has he just like let himself go like that so he can climb out the small window? Which,
but you know what? I haven't thought of that, but
mate, it's a silly take. What are we to derive from that depiction, that physical depiction of him, where you know he elicits this poor creature response, and then at the end when the banker's read the thing, he sort of puts his hand sort of thoughtfully on him as if he wasn't going to off him a few minutes ago, and he heads off. And what, just on that physical thing before we get to our final few things that we want to look at, maybe some symbolism in the story, what did you make of that physical appearance, and do you think there was any significance to it?
See, it's that physical appearance that makes me think, for within the framework of this story, the banker had the correct arguments, because the banker says, what is it? The execution kills instantly, life imprisonment kills by degrees. Who is the more humane executioner? One who kills you in a few seconds, or one who draws the life out of you incessantly for years? I would say that description that you've just given, and obviously Chekhov gave first, is very much the picture of a man who's had the life drawn out of him.
Yeah, that's good, man. That's good. Yeah, I like that. That's good. I think you're dead right. That's exactly it, isn't it? That's exactly it. It's the physical manifestation of that idea that he described. It's great. You know, it's made manifest in front of him in the form of this poor wretched creature. I mean, there are so many things, man, that I wanted to talk and tease out with you, but we're getting to that stage of the evening again where we could talk all night, and maybe we shouldn't, and maybe we should just pick out one or two things. I have a little thing I want to talk to you about, some of the symbolism in the story, and again I'm going to throw these out at you. Let's do them kind of quick fire. First of all, the books, I think the symbolism involved in the books is quite rich. To me, it was basically the books were like the sum of all mankind's knowledge and experience. Mm. But the key thing is that the books can only offer you that vicarious experience. They can give you all the knowledge in the world, but the experience is vicarious. So I think that's that. But there is one I wanted to run past you. We mentioned it briefly. The early days where he has the piano and he's playing the music and then he just stops. Why do you think he goes to the piano in the early days and then abandons it completely? I have a theory, but I'd like to hear yours.
Do you know what? We were talking about this before. And you know what? And that's what's really good about this story. Like you said, we could talk about it for hours and I could tell you about 20 million other things that I sort of found in it. But you know, the one thing that I paid no attention to at all was the piano. That really, I think because I got in my head so much this idea of like the Renaissance man and like, you know, the reading and becoming learned and what have you, that I forgot the arty side of his character, you know. I forgot the fact that he likes to have a little fiddle around on the piano. So I've actually given the piano no prior thought whatsoever. So I'm happy to hear your thoughts.
Look, can I suggest something? Because to me, there's obviously an immensely strong connection between emotion and music. And I think in those early days, he's allowing himself to experience that sadness. And I think playing the music is allowing himself to feel sad and feel heartbroken. And you can compare and contrast that with the sort of detached sort of figure that we find at the end, who's written those words about despising the world and everything in it. And I think that might be it. I think that to me was what it was, the piano and the subsequent abandonment of it is him maybe abandoning that deeply felt sadness and moving on to the next stage. The gospel in this story and the reading of the gospels, and the banker was sort of thinking, why is he, how come he's spending so long on this?
I love that bit. I think that's a really, really powerful image. Just the idea of the man sitting there for a year with just one book.
With one book.
I think it's great that.
He calls it like a comparatively thin volume or something. He said, you know, he's all the information in the world. He's been reading deeply of all these things. He's learned all these languages. And why? And I think that's beautiful because, again, I think those 15 years, you mentioned it before, there's stages. And, of course, he comes to the stage where an awful lot of people come to across the course of their life, and he gets religion and he's obsessed by it. But what's really interesting is, again, it's abandoned. He it's as if there's the faith stage and then I'll read about some other religions. Oh, okay. And then that starts to wobble. And then he's doing that random multi-subject and multi-topic reading that's kind of sporadic and kind of indicative of a fella who certainly has not got any deep religious faith. So I thought that that was in itself a little metaphor for that stage that people get very devout and
yeah.
But with him it didn't take. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but again, you know, we talked, didn't we, about this story is full of lots of like little contradictions, and because it looks like, in terms of, it talks about the books being strewn everywhere and what have you, and he's abandoned the Bible and he's abandoned this, but then it is the final part of his letter is where he essentially says, you know, you've all bartered earth for heaven. So he shows that he does, I think he does believe in heaven, and he believes that it's like, it's the afterlife as such that is the more important thing, and that's meaningless. And which makes me just think, he's just a man who's not really thinking straight, to be honest. He's got, like, you know, like, as we all are, you just have a muddled jumble of lots of ideas, and it's quite difficult to sort of make sense of one thing. I mean, it's like, I don't know, I'm just trying to figure, so, you know, it's if you believe in evolution and you're religious at the same time. I mean, that's a difficult one to sort of to balance up, you know. There's some contradictory information there, and you want to sort of, you know, you might want to stick to your sort of religious belief, but you're looking at the facts of evolution and that doesn't sort of tie in. And I think he's just having that same, I think it's quite reflective of, you know, like, what life can be like as a whole. You do acquire all of this information, and you can't put everything into nice neat boxes. Not everything does make sense, and you will contradict yourself unknowingly sometimes. I mean, there's the line which I really liked in it, because it was about, he read through as he was swimming in the sea among broken pieces of wreckage, and in his desire to save his life, was eagerly grasping one piece after another. And I think that very much is sort of reflective of exactly what he's doing. He's trying to save his life. He's trying to sort of keep himself engaged or occupied or stimulated or find some sort of meaning. And he's grabbing for all lots of different things. And I think maybe that might be a metaphor for sort of, you know, wider life. I do think, is this 15 years imprisonment almost sort of a microcosm of a larger life in some ways? I mean, but who knows?
You know what? I love that. I think you've taken it to a nice place for us to sort of wrap it up. It's been a very, very engaging conversation. I thank you for the ideas and the responses to my nonsense. And it's been, again, very, very enjoyable. We will be back with a third episode for you quite soon. So keep your eyes on the various channels where that information will be put out. And Pooley, I mean, again, it's going to be a surprise for yourself. So in a few minutes when the mics go off, I'll be letting you know what the next one is. And I think it's something that I'm enjoying immensely. I hope you're getting a kick out of this series. And I don't know, it's starting to become real, Pooley. We've got the artwork, we've got the music, we've got a few of them in the can now, and I'm loving it.
It's good, Trev, and we're doing this on a Friday night. It's the new rock and roll, it is.
Quality. And on that note, we'll see you next time.